From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Midnight tomorrow, April 15th, is your last chance to file your taxes on time. Ever wondered what happens if you don't pay up? In his new book, Confessions of a Tax Collector, Richard Yancey tells all about his 12 years collecting the government's due. Tonight on Point, one man's tour of duty inside the Internal Revenue Service. But first, a look at who's paying what in American taxes today, at who's getting audited and who's not. David K. Johnston reports on taxes for the New York Times and is author of Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. I asked him what the big news on taxes is on this year's eve of April 15th.
Well, the newest data that's coming out is showing a tremendous shift in the tax burden off of the highest income Americans and corporations onto the middle class and the upper middle class. There's a new report from the General Accounting Office, that's the investigative arm of Congress, that shows that more than 60% of corporations from 96 to 2000, the five fat years during the Clinton administration, paid no corporate income tax.
How is that happening? Is this by design or not?
It's a combination of factors. Some of it is the special interest provisions that corporations have gotten into the tax code. Some of it is undoubtedly abusive tax shelters that the IRS is now belatedly going after some of, and we don't have a full explanation of the rest of it, but it is certainly astonishing that in the most profitable years, we've had this huge shift away from corporations.
So you're saying the tax burden is shifting from corporations to individuals or from wealthy individuals to middle-class individuals?
Well, both. The lifting of the burden is on people at the very top of the income ladder, and off of corporations both, and that means it falls onto the middle class and the upper middle class. The Internal Revenue Service has come out with new data from the 2001 tax returns, and what it shows is that people who made $10 million a year or more, that's about 7,000 families whose average income is $25.6 million, they paid a smaller share of their income in federal income taxes than people who made from $400,000 to $10 million. Now, if you're at the $400,000 level, you worked all year to make what people in the top group make every 6 days, but you had a heavier tax burden than they did.
And what if you're in the $40,000 level, where many more Americans live?
I don't know the number for $40,000. If you're at the $60,000 level, you paid about one-third the share of your income that people did at the $25 million level. That is, you paid about 10.8% versus about 26%. Mm-hmm. But if you add Social Security taxes in, then people at the $60,000 level paid a larger share of their income in federal taxes than people at the $25.6 million level.
Clearly, part of this is built into the tax provisions, but part of this may flow from IRS enforcement as well, with people getting their tax returns to the post office tonight. Where is IRS enforcement being focused?
To the degree that there is enforcement, it's being focused right now on tax sheltering activities by high-income individuals and corporations and on some of the thousands of abusive schemes from people out there selling the notion that you really don't have to pay taxes, no law requires you to, or that you can just cook up lines on paper and claim that these are tax-deductible expenses. But the enforcement is so weak that the IRS Oversight Board, which is a citizen panel Congress created to monitor the IRS, told Congress 2 weeks ago that 78% of known cheats in partnerships are not even being asked to pay the money.
So does that mean that American individuals, I hate to say this, it's not very civic, but don't need to worry about being audited?
Oh, I think you need to be worried about being audited, and if you get caught, the results can be quite dramatic. And judges in the past few months have been handing out really long prison sentences to the few tax evaders who are being sentenced, in some cases 15 and 20 years for cheating on your taxes.
Wow.
In addition, if you're a wage earner, you pretty much can't cheat. The cheating is primarily going on among business owners, investors, and landlords because they control what the government knows about their finances, and there is very, very little auditing of them, a tiny fraction of 1% of those returns.
You've just written about the corporate risk of a tax audit still shrinking.
Right.
Down to that fraction of 1%. What about that? How does it compare with the risk of an audit that corporations faced, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, as recently as 1995, more than half of all large companies, and they pay about 85% of corporate taxes, were audited. Now we're down to just about half that number, 29%. And I've been interviewing revenue agents all across the country who say that they are under orders to speed up the audits, to overlook items, to do the most superficial job they possibly can, but generate statistics indicating that they're conducting audits. Not quality audits, but audits.
The Bush administration rhetoric on this has been pretty tough. President Bush has said again and again he won't tolerate corporate cheating malfeasance.
That's correct, but the performance, as Syracuse University showed in data this week, has not matched the rhetoric. There has been a continuing decline of tax law enforcement. The decline began back in 1988. It was quite steep during the Clinton years, and it has continued with one exception during the Bush administration. There has been a slight, and I do mean slight, uptick in audits of high-income individuals during the most recent year. Now, the administration says, give us another year or two, our statistics will look better, but the size of the IRS relative to the tax system continues to shrink. So I don't see how it's possible that there'll be any serious upturn in enforcement.
So is the slide in enforcement due to the population growing and the IRS not growing? Do they simply not have the resources to enforce more vigorously, or what's going on?
Well, both the IRS Oversight Board and the General Accounting Office, the investigative arm of Congress, say exactly that, and so do a number of recent former IRS commissioners. The IRS essentially today has half the resources per tax return that it had in 1988, and the tax system is vastly more complicated because Congress has passed all these additional laws that have increased the complexity of the tax system, and it's passed laws that slow down and complicate both audits of taxpayers and the collection process. So when you add all those together, my guess is the IRS's resources are closer to one-third what they had in 1988 per tax return.
David K. Johnson, you've paid a lot of attention to this and written very thoughtful about it. What are the social implications of this shift of the tax burden onto the middle class and on more corporate taxpayers cutting out on paying taxes?
Well, the short-term implication is that the government is running huge deficits, which cannot continue without there being an economic consequence, and that many people in the middle class have had their ability to save so that they can prosper stripped away by the tax system. Well, people at the very top who are now have had at the very, very top a 41% reduction since 1993 in their tax burden are able to save more and more. And as they become wealthier, of course, their political power grows. The long-run implications are quite different. First of all, Americans don't understand, I think, that this has been happening to them. But as they do, it raises serious questions about national cohesion, about people's support for the idea of democracy. Clearly, there are a large number of people, I estimate at least a million of them, who are going around describing the federal government openly as a criminal organization, which is a terrible consequence.
You're suggesting these are people who are no longer respect the kind of tax bond between citizen and government.
That's exactly correct. And I found them all over the country, and I've never had any difficulty finding them. I've been able to engage people in conversations all over the country who, once they start talking with you, start expressing these kinds of views. And I think that's very, very troubling for the country. And instead of getting what we need, which is fundamental tax reform so that our tax system works with the economy instead of against it, members of Congress simply treat tax as a four-letter word. They continue to raise money in return for giving specific tax relief to interest groups and individuals. And our economy is suffering, and in the long run, our democracy will suffer.
David K. Johnston, thanks for joining us. It's tough news, but we're glad to be informed. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
David K. Johnston is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He spoke with me from New York. Richard Yancey was an aspiring 28-year-old writer who hung out with a theater crowd when he saw a help wanted ad in his local paper for a revenue officer, that is, tax collector. He was dubious about working for the IRS, but he liked the pay and the prospect of a steady job. As it turned out, he loved the work, maybe too much. He became a fiercely competitive tax collector, wanting to collect more money and seize more property than any other revenue officer in his region. He went undercover, sifted through garbage, and wasn't above a good car chase or intimidation session to collect what the government was due. He called it feeding the beast. Tonight on Point, one man's campaign to fill the government's coffer. Tell the truth, are you or have you ever been a tax cheat? Have you been tempted? What keeps you in line? And if you've slipped, has the IRS played hardball with you? How was it? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Richard Yancey. He worked for 12 years as a revenue officer at the Internal Revenue Service. His new book is Confessions of a Tax Collector, One Man's Tour of Duty Inside the IRS. Good evening and welcome, Richard Yancey.
Good evening, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks a lot for being with us. So there you were, an English major out of college, kind of sounds like mooching off a widow older than yourself, not knowing where you were going, and you decided to become a tax collector?
Yeah, and almost 13 years later, I was still in a state of shock, I guess. Yeah, I opened up the Sunday paper, and there was an ad for a government job. Now, it didn't mention that it was the Internal Revenue Service. It just said it was a government job. And it had the starting salary in bold type at the bottom of the ad, which is what had really caught my eye. And so I went down to an open house, and it wasn't until I went through the doors of the federal building that I realized it was the Internal Revenue Service.
And there you were in the belly of the beast and spent a dozen years feeding the beast. We want to hear exactly how that worked, and we have to acknowledge right off the bat that there's a certain historical angle to this because, as you'll explain to us, in 1998 the laws were changed, so you had a little less freedom to go with the cowboy attitude, as you put it. But only today, Richard Yancey, in the New York Times, you've got an op-ed essay saying that only the little people pay taxes, Leona Helmsley once said, and it's true. Our government makes sure of it. What do you mean by that?
I mean exactly what the kind of things that David K. Johnson has been saying. It was certainly in my experience, from my direct experience, that the IRS goes to where the money is owed, and revenue officers don't choose their inventories. Revenue officers don't choose
their inventories. Which, that is what?
That's the cases that they have to work. The inventory of taxpayer accounts that are assigned to them. Those are assigned to them. They cannot choose. And the taxpayers that I visited were not big businesses. They were the self-employed. They were the small business owner with less than 15 employees.
You say the carpet installer, the daycare center operator, Walmart clerk, carpenter, print shop owner.
Right. Pet shop owner, painter, an artist, like a sculptor or something.
So just so we've got the role right, you were not the auditor. You weren't the guy who sat down
correct.
With them to say, we think we've got a problem here. This is after the IRS confirmed to their own satisfaction there was a problem. There were unpaid or underpaid taxes. And you were sicked on those cases. Go get the money.
That was exactly my mission, was to go get the money. The IRS's position was then and is still that the revenue officer, the tax collector, is the last stop in the line. It's the service's last attempt to collect back due taxes. And therefore, out of that function of that job flows the philosophy, if you will, that the taxpayers had their chance to pay up. They've had up to four notices. They've had multiple phone calls, and the money is still owed.
And now the heavy comes in. We've just got a minute before the break, but what was off limits to you in terms of squeezing the money out of people? There's a lot of squeezing in this book. What couldn't you do?
Well, certainly we couldn't do anything that any normal citizen couldn't do. I mean, we couldn't wiretap a phone. We couldn't trespass onto people's property in order to spy on them. But within, the confines of things that you could do, we pushed the envelope quite a bit.
I got to say, I'm reading things in here that I don't know about normal citizens typically doing to one another. we'll hear more about that. Richard Yancey, we've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with Richard Yancey. He worked for 12 years as a revenue officer at the Internal Revenue Service. His new book is Confessions of a Tax Collector, One Man's Tour of Duty Inside the IRS. And we'd really want to hear your stories, listeners, if you're willing to share them. Tell the truth. Do you cheat? Are you tempted to cheat? Have you been audited? How was it? Have you been caught shortchanging Uncle Sam? And has the IRS played hardball with you? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about shaking the tree for tax money and one man's tour of duty inside the IRS. My guest is Richard Yancey. He is author of the new book, Confessions of a Tax Collector. You can join our conversation tonight. Tell the truth. Do you cheat? Are you tempted to cheat? Have you been audited? How was it? Have you been caught shortchanging Uncle Sam? Has the IRS played hardball with you? How bad? How rough did it get? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Richard Yancey, you write that the IRS is governed by people who've grown up in a culture of fear and intimidation. And clearly, you were instructed and left free to use both when you went about your business. Begin to take us in here. How did you, earn your stripes as a tax collector? Give us a sense of some of the early cases, some of the tough cases that you encountered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you're hired to be a tax collector or a revenue officer, as the Internal Revenue Service calls them, mm-hmm. You're given an intensive training that lasts 6 weeks. Then you come back from your training and you're assigned what was called an on-the-job instructor. This is a seasoned revenue officer, someone who'd been around for a while. And they were your coach. They were your guide. They're the ones who helped you navigate through the mind-boggling, complex tax code.
Okay.
And the procedures that the IRS had established to enforce that code.
That is, procedures to squeeze the money or the property out of people who they felt had not paid up.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay.
And the whole training period, you're a probationary employee for an entire year. And it's at the end of that year that the IRS decides whether you have the right stuff or not to stay on. But the intention was, at least back in the early 90s when I started, was to break you. That was specifically the point. And I was told by the man who hired me that we will intend to break – that is our intention. We plan to try to break you down because we want to see if you can take – what you have to be able to take doing this job.
You mean like Marine boot camp, they wanted to break you down so then you would then go out and just be an invincible fighting machine.
Exactly. I mean, there's a certain amount of, checking your own personality and your own empathy at the door.
You say that
when you come in those doors.
The on-the-job trainer informed you earlier in your career if you wanted to advance in the IRS, you had to seize assets. It didn't matter what you seized. You just had to get out there and seize assets.
Right, and this is what comes back to what I call the atmosphere of fear and intimidation that existed then and still exists within the IRS. That's how you rose in that division, in the collection division. You rose by seizing assets. The revenue officer, he's the one person, or she is the one person in the Internal Revenue Service that can, under the civil enforcement mm-hmm. of the laws, mm-hmm. can actually confiscate assets. So that's what got you noticed. You weren't a hotshot revenue officer if you were pushing paper around, if you were reporting a bunch of cases uncollectible, for example.
Just show me the money was the attitude.
Right. The more seizures you could do and the more high-profile seizures you could do, the more attention you would get and the more likelihood of you being rewarded
high profile,
promotions
but,
and awards.
But you're talking about carpet installers and daycare center operators. They don't sound high-profile.
When I say high-profile, I mean a seizure that may be delicate politically, for example, seizing someone's personal residence. I have a story that I tell that kind of spans the whole length of the book that involves a daycare operator that was my very first case.
Okay.
And she was the lady had never graduated from high school, and she reached middle age. She had three children, and her husband took off from her with his next door neighbor's daughter, her 18-year-old daughter, and she was left with just the roof over her head, over her and her children's heads. And
great. Sounds like a great target for the government's power.
And she loved taking care of children, so she had the idea of opening up her own business and running a daycare out of her home. Well, by the time that the IRS got around to her, and this is another problem with the way the collection system works, but by the time the IRS got around to her, she owed $50,000 approximately in taxes.
And what kind of income did she typically have?
Oh, she was losing money. She could barely meet her necessary living expenses.
All right.
So
tell us, how did she come to owe that $50,000? She had underreported what she was paid by her?
No, it was payroll taxes. She had hired a couple of people to help her with the kids, and it was actually the payroll taxes that she owed.
Mm-hmm.
So I was faced with a decision early on, very early on in my career, about taking this woman's house because it was basically the only thing of value that she had in order to satisfy the taxes. And that's what I mean when I call something a seizure that might be high profile, because Congress had recently changed the law in terms of personal residence seizures where it required four levels of approval. In other words, my boss had to approve it, their boss had to approve it, and on up the line. So it got looked at by a lot of eyes, and it got you a lot of attention. Usually it wasn't done that much because most revenue officers did not want the district director to be looking closely at their case files.
Give us the plot line of this particular story. So here she is. She's barely making ends meet. She's not really making ends meet. The IRS wants his $50,000. It wants her house. Mm-hmm. What did she think of that, tax collector man?
She wasn't too happy about it. She was one of those, eternal optimists that always thought, next month I'm going to turn a corner if I just had a little more time. And the reason I really chose, because I've worked literally hundreds and hundreds of taxpayer accounts in the 13 years that I was with the IRS, but the reason this case really sticks out in my mind is it really seems to bring to fore all the issues that a revenue officer has to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Take us in.
Yeah, weighing the rights and the needs of the taxpayer against what the government is demanding that you do. If I strictly followed the book on that case, and of course the IRS has a book for everything, there's a flow chart for everything, but if I had followed the book, I would have set a demand for her to either borrow the money on the house, sell the house, and give me the money. And if she did not meet that deadline, I would start in motion what I needed to do to seize and sell that house.
So did you do it? Did you put a padlock on her door?
No, I did not. And I think that comes down to why I'm no longer with the IRS.
But I have to say, Richard Yancey, along the way, you were pretty gung-ho. I mean, there are a lot of down and dirty collection stories in here. You had plenty of cowboy attitude. I wish you'd share with us some of the – give us some moments for when you were really going for it, no holds barred.
Well, look, you first got to understand that I was 28 years old when I started with the Internal Revenue Service. I really felt like I had no real direction in my life. I didn't feel like I was a success at anything that I had halfway attempted. And I suddenly found myself in an environment where I was able to put aside any self-doubt because the success was so tangible. There's nothing more successful, to make you feel more successful than to hold a big fat check in your hand. I mean, this was something that wasn't ephemeral. This was something very tangible. That's the motorcycle I seized. That's the car I took. This is the big check that I collected today. So part of it was it made me feel like a efficacious person, like someone that was successful.
Well, let us decide how efficacious you were. Give us some tales. Tell us how you did it. We'll decide how tough you were.
Well, I found a way to do the job and really love it at the same time. I have to preface this story a little bit because I was dealing with illegal tax protesters, which is a parlance of the IRS for those people who openly defy the government and the government's right or ability to collect taxes.
Mm-hmm.
That cast me in the role as, at least to me, as Elliot Ness. I was the good guy. I was the guy in the white hat.
On the side of right.
Guys.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. I was on the side of right. I was Dudley Do Right. And these people had creative, very clever at times ways of hiding assets and thwarting the efforts of collection on the government. So, for example, I would follow people to work. I'd get up early in the morning and stake out their houses. And when these people got in their cars to go to a job, they're usually self-employed people, by the way, who rarely netted more than $20,000 a year. But I would follow them to work so I know a place to send my garnishment notice. I would call third parties on the phone and pretend to be someone else, either a relative of the taxpayers or friends, in order to try to locate where the taxpayer was. I had quite an unfortunate incident, which I describe in detail in the book, in which I totally lost all sense of perspective and actually took a couple of garbage sacks that were sitting on the curb, threw them in the trunk of my car, drove to another place, and proceeded to go through the garbage looking for levy sources, looking for bank statements or anything else that might point me in the direction of some money or some assets.
So you were gung-ho, but it got worse or more dramatic. Didn't I read you had a car chase? The guy threw his girlfriend out of the car.
Yes.
She's laying by the side of the road, injured, and you just stayed on his tail. You drove right past her, revenue man.
That may have been my very lowest point of all, Tom. My very lowest point of all. That memory troubles me greatly. Now, I should tell people that, you know, I found out later. I don't really make it explicit in the book, but I do find out later that she was okay. She wasn't you know, horribly injured in that incident. But
now you rationalize.
There was a fight that broke out in the car between the two of them, and he does push her, and she did fall out of the car. And at the time, I did rationalize it away by saying, you know, obviously this couple wasn't fighting because the IRS was tailing them in a car. You know, this would happen regardless.
Yeah, but in a lot of these cases, you've got real human drama that's playing out exactly because there's so much money owed and exactly because the pressure's on. Of course, your on-the-job trainer, Culpepper, he laid it out pretty flamboyantly here when you were getting ready to head out on the job. He said, think about it, Yancey. If you don't think about anything else when you go home tonight, think about this. With a stroke of your pen, you can take away someone's life savings. You can take their paycheck. You can take their car. You can take everything they own except the clothes on their back. And sometimes you can take that if you do it right. It's simple. They owe taxes. You can do that. You can do all that. And on whose authority can you do that? On your own. You're like a medieval prince. You have the right to everything. Let's get some calls. Larry's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just like to speak on this issue.
Okay.
I started off years ago in the federal building. I started off internal security. I set up the federal building. I helped set up security for the federal building. I moved up to criminal investigation division. I was the assistant to Internal Revenue Service, and I worked out of criminal investigation.
All right.
I know what the revenue officers used to do. I used to sit there in the office. Rich people would come in and owe money. They'd walk in with a lawyer with a briefcase, and they wouldn't pay anything, not a fraction of what they owed. They just walked in with a lawyer, paid a certain amount of money, and it was settled. We had a revenue agent who was killed in the Buffalo, New York office because he was squeezing this poor man so much that the man snapped. I worked there for years, and finally I had to leave. And when I sit here and I listen to this individual talk about how ruthless he was, and we already knew poor people paid the taxes. If you had money, Tom, you didn't pay any taxes because they would bargain with you. But if you didn't have any money, they would charge you in the interest rates. They would attach to it. You couldn't afford it. You couldn't hire a lawyer and fight it.
And, Larry, I hear it right in your voice. You couldn't take it anymore.
I really couldn't. And I'm sitting here listening to him chuckle and laugh about how rough he was on poor people. Poor people were the only one who paid. I sat there and watched. I was investigation. I sat there.
Larry, we got it. I want to be fair to Richard Yancey. In fact, in his book, he takes us right into a lot of the pathos now, looking back, that those people were suffering sometimes at his hands. But you're right. He says it himself. These were carpet installers, print shop owners, carpenters. Larry, thanks for your call. And we hear the emotion in your voice about it even now. Richard Yancey, you're walking a tightrope here. On the one hand, you are conveying how rough and tough you were, and it's kind of stunning stuff. On the other hand, you have laid out here the sort of path of human toll that was behind you.
Right, exactly. And I hate to give the impression that I think it's funny about what I became. I think that's one of the object lessons of this book, is that it's not so much an expose of the IRS or even our tax system in this country, but what absolute power can do to one person. No, I'm not proud of what I did, and I don't think that some of what I did was funny, and I certainly don't think some of the dilemmas that people were in that came about through no fault of my own is funny. None of that is funny. In fact, there's a reason I'm no longer working for the Internal Revenue Service. I mean, Tom, I think you mentioned at the opening the piece in the New York Times that ran today, and I hope Larry and people who feel that, you know, I'm somehow laughing at other people's pain, pick that up and take a look at it, because it is not my position that what I did was, you know, something to brag to my children about.
But you were young, and you were in the swing of it,
young.
And you were going with it. You write today, most of the people that you targeted netted less than $30,000 per year. Most
right.
operated out of a rundown storefront in a tired strip mall. Most were honest people who knew my arrival was the death knell of their American dream. Darla's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Darla. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank
Hi.
You for sure. taking my call.
Good to have you.
I want to know is... There's a situation where a family hasn't filed, not out of dishonesty, but just because there's been a lot of illness and chaos and craziness.
Mm-hmm. Some family that you might know. Mm-hmm.
Right. And does the IRS make except, will they be reasonable, merciful, you know, they look at the situations like illness, for example, depression, that sort of thing.
Yep.
So, anyway, that's my question. I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay, we got it. Is there room for mercy? Thanks, Darla, for your call. Richard Jancy, you've got the question. It sounds like this family may be pretty close to home. And I know since 1998 things are different, but what about very specifically here, taxes not filed because of illness, because of, Darla says, craziness, maybe depression. Is there room for mercy built into the tax code?
Yes, if you mean by mercy, is there can be in certain circumstances, like she has described, waiver of certain penalties, not of interest. Interest won't be waived, but and the first step is, you know, acknowledging, of course, that it probably is something that you need to take care of, and the second step is to be proactive. That's what I tell everyone. You know, don't wait for them to send someone like Richard Jancy to their door. You know. Be proactive with your problem with the Internal Revenue Service. Give them a call. Go in to visit the local office. Write a letter. Go ahead and get the returns prepared and ready to file. And then my advice to you, Darla, is or this friend of yours, is to get a professional to represent you before the Internal Revenue Service. It's been my experience that because it's such an issue that cuts to so close to people's emotional cores, their finances. That it's kind of like what Ben Franklin said about having yourself if you represent yourself, you've got your a fool for a client.
Mm-hmm.
You really should have a someone who's not disinterested but dispassionate about your, you know, about the situation and can deal with it on a professional level with people of the Internal Revenue Service.
Maybe hard to hire when you're broke.
Yeah, and well, of course, that's the other issue. If you can't afford to, you know, the IRS does it. You know, we'll waive certain failing to file penalties for hardship situations.
We've got to take a short break. We're talking with Richard Jancy, author of the new book, Confessions of a Tax Collector, One Man's Tour of Duty Inside the IRS. Does the specter of a Richard Jancy keep you honest? Do you have nightmares about the tax man putting a padlock on your front door? And what keeps you paying your taxes? Is it fear or civic duty? Or do you pay? Are you on the lam from the tax man? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about shaking the tree for tax money. My guest is Richard Jancy. He's author of the new book, Confessions of a Tax Collector, One Man's Tour of Duty Inside the IRS. He spent a dozen years as a revenue officer, a tax collector, and he shook the tree hard. You can join the conversation tonight. Have you been caught shortchanging Uncle Sam? Have you had a real run-in with the tax collector? How bad, how rough did it get? Is stern enforcement required to keep everybody paying their fair share? Do you believe everybody's paying their fair share? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. William is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great, thanks.
I just want I gave a fake name, and you're not tracing my call, are you?
You got it. We are not.
I cheat on my taxes pretty much whenever I can because I feel disenfranchised. I really don't trust the government and what they're doing with my money, and that it's in my best interest. And the way that the government has been known for spending money frivolously, I just don't agree with it. And I refuse to be a lemming and just follow everybody just because it seems to be the right thing to do.
But, Richard, William, let me ask you, who's going to educate the kids? Who's going to keep the potholes out of the roads? Who's going to take care of you when you're old?
Well, I feel like I pay my share. I definitely pay my share, but I know that there are corporations out there who are getting through loopholes and are finding ways to get out of paying their share, and rich people, and I just refuse to be one of the lower income bracket people that's just paying just because he's being muscled into it. So I pay my share, but
only when you have to, and you don't whenever you can get away with it. William, stick with me here. Richard Yancey, speak directly to William. You were the tax collector. What do you say to him?
Well, my standard line always was, you know, your complaint is a valuable. It's got some validity to it. I mean, yeah, is it fair? Is it right that the big corporations can, not have to pay their taxes, so the burden falls to the little guy to have to pay? No, that's not fair.
So, are you encouraging him to cheat whenever he can get away with it?
No, but what I would encourage him to do is say, you know, we still live in a representative democracy, and if you don't think your government is spending the money you think your money the way you think it should be spent, then you have a recourse. You can, talk to your congressman, talk to your senators from your state.
William, how about it? Pay your taxes and vote. Is that a satisfying equation?
And I'm very active in political issues and voicing my opinion and voting and things like that. But that doesn't put the extra money in my pocket every year. It just doesn't. It's an elitist government, and I refuse to be ripped off just because I'm not going to be a lemming.
I hear it. Richard Yancey, what are the odds that William will be caught?
Not good right now.
Why not?
Enforcement is at an all-time low. The statistics are horrible. Things are not going well in terms of enforcement. But the argument to me seems, I may not agree where they put a certain stop sign in my neighborhood. I might think that stop sign is wrong. I'm still required by law to come to a stop when I come to that sign.
Yep.
Whether I agree with the government's decision to put that sign there or not, I'm required by law to come to a full stop.
And if the odds aren't great that he'll be caught, but if he is caught, what's going to happen to someone like William? He says
he's lower income.
He's ducked some taxes here whenever he could.
It doesn't sound like they would try to criminally prosecute someone like that, who's doing something like that. But probably be hit with some pretty heavy civil penalties.
And if he doesn't have the cash to pay up,
then the penalties will stay there for 10 years, and anytime he files a return, they'll take the refund.
And if there's no refund?
Then they'll file a notice of federal tax lien at wherever he lives that will attach to anything he owes or anything he acquires in the 10 years that the IRS has to collect taxes.
And what kind of property did you seize in your 12 years as a collector to pay those bills, Richard Yancey?
Oh, I've houses. I've seized mortgages. I've seized bank accounts, obviously, whole inventories of businesses.
You can have my mortgage. What do you mean you seized a mortgage?
This person was a mortgage holder.
Oh, I see.
They were a private mortgage holder. They held the note on another house, and I seized that note and turned around and sold it.
Cars? Smaller property?
Oh, yes. Many, many cars. Mostly cars. Mostly rather run-down, dilapidated cars, as I talk about in the piece for the Times. You know, to come full circle, really, and get to why I'm sitting here and not, sitting at a desk collecting taxes, mm-hmm. I frankly couldn't stomach it anymore. I mean, yeah, there was a part of it that appealed to me. Yeah, I made pretty good money for what I did. And yeah, it did make me feel somewhat successful, I suppose you could say. But I was not happy with what I was doing. And it had come to the point where I really felt it was unconscionable what the government was asking me to do. I had been to enough of those tired strip malls. I had walked through enough weed-choked fields to examine some broken-down piece of farm equipment. I had enough, and there wasn't any particular point in time or a case that I can really point at. It's just I gradually came to the realization that, I really had a choice. The tax system in this country and is monumentally – the way it's enforced – and the way the tax laws themselves are written, it's grossly unfair.
William, in
and
Milwaukee,
I had a choice. I could be a part of it, or I could walk away, and I decided to walk away.
We see that, and I just want to say to William in Milwaukee, at the end of the day, we want to have a country where we've got some things we share, too, like schools, like roads, like hospitals and the rest. And I kind of like Richard Yancey's formula here. Pay the taxes, but vote, and vote in your own interest. Greg is calling from, and the communal interest, Greg is calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I know the amateur psychologists there are going to love this, but
okay.
Growing up, my father thought pretty much that the rules didn't apply to him. And he loved not paying his taxes.
What kind of work did he do, Greg?
He was a plumber, self-employed.
Okay.
And, you know, he thought that anything was a tax deduction, and he tried it for years and years. And finally, well, he was sloppy, and he got audited, and he got caught, and he ended up having to pay a pretty stiff fine. But, you know, I remember, you know, when he was lamenting over the rest of it, of course, you don't say this to him directly.
Or right.
Backside across the face. But, you know, my attitude was like, you know, you had it coming. I mean,
You were trimming all those years, and why should you get away with it?
Yeah, I mean, it never came to the point where we had you know, someone like Mr. Yancey coming after us. You know, he had to pay a fine. He paid it. But, you know, I mean, yes, it's unfortunate that, you know, the system does seem to be tilted towards those who are less able to defend themselves. And I won't say that the ends justify the means. But, you know, if you aren't paying your taxes, you know, in my book, I'm sorry, you know, you owe them and you should pay them. And you know, you opened the show talking about, you know, a very emotional appeal, like, well, what about the single people or the daycare center?
Yeah. Like,
if they're not paying their taxes, you know, well, you know, they are given the opportunities. They are given, you know, the audits, and they're given the chance to defend
themselves. Yeah, we hear you. It is the law, and it is a kind of community responsibility.
And there's a process involved.
There's a process. Richard Jensen, how about it? Greg says just because you're a little guy doesn't mean you shouldn't be caught. You shouldn't pay up.
And I agree. And Greg, I think they are looking to hire some revenue officers, and you sound like, you know,
the right
perfect
stuff.
Candidate. I mean, you've got the right timber in you. You know, this was something that we heard over and over and over, and not to play amateur psychologist either, but it certainly was, at least it struck me, that a lot of this was repeated almost by rote to make ourselves feel good about what we were doing.
But isn't it true? I mean, everyone does.
Yes,
have
I mean, that's fundamentally true,
to
isn't
chip
it?
In here.
Yeah, I mean, it isn't that fundamentally true? It is not fair. I mean, I'm paying all my taxes. You know, it's not fair that someone thinks or Tim's or for whatever reason doesn't pay all theirs. And the argument that collection at least always put forth was, you know, it's not fair in terms of what America is about. Because America is about competition. I mean, free enterprise. And if your competitor is undercutting you on his bids because he's not paying his payroll taxes and you are, well, that's fundamentally unfair.
So, Richard Jensen, did you just lose your taste for a job that, in fact, has to be done? Or are you saying somehow that even though, yes, it's the law, it's everyone's responsibility, but people shouldn't, needn't pay anyway?
No, I don't feel the latter at all. I think it's closer to the former, but I also think that there's an element there of that the tax laws have become it's so upside down. The biggest corporations reaping in millions of dollars while not having to pay a penny in taxes is while I go out there and get in my car and go talk to the daycare operator or on my very first contact sees and shut down the little old guy's muffler shop that's been in his family for 75 years. You know, after a while, you know, that has a psychological toll on you. It has a psychological effect. But I do agree. It is a necessary job. As long as there's a government, there's going to be taxes. And as long as there's a tax system, there's going to be taxes that have to be collected. And I'll tell you something that comes as a surprise to some people is most of the collectors that I knew within the IRS did not favor an income tax, would prefer if Congress passed some sort of national sales tax.
Yeah.
Or flat tax, even though that might mean them losing their jobs.
Just because it was so messy and sometimes so humane. And when you paint that big picture, it sure cries out for some kind of political solution. Justin is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Justin. You're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
I was one of those people. I was a cabinet installer. And one year, my wife and I paid in excess of $50,000 in combined taxes. We had four children in daycare.
That was pretty good carpet installation year.
Well, it was because of a bracket move and no deductions. It was just a horrendous year.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a good year. It was a good year. But anyhow, to make a long story short, the following year I decided. I think I overestimated it. The following year, I decided I wasn't going to pay taxes ever again.
Right, okay.
And became a scofflaw. And that led to me being called by the IRS. And then they eventually put a lien on my credit and my wife. And the former figure that I quoted to you is the figure that I ended up having to pay the IRS. I think the figure we paid in combined was like $10,000 in actuality.
So were they fierce, Justin? Were they tough? Were they rough? Did they scare you?
No, they would come in regularly and sweep my checking account, and I would get really aggravated even more because they take all the money out of your account.
Boom.
And then they leave you with a bill like $25 that you got to pay because they did it.
Ouch.
But what I learned over a period of time, not because of what they did to me or what I did to myself, actually, was that, I owe taxes. I should pay my taxes. If I don't pay my taxes, my state taxes, my federal taxes, schools don't get built, teachers don't get paid, highway taxes come out of gasoline. We live in a free country because we pay taxes.
And a lot of it is built by exactly those taxes. Justin, our time's running down, but we've got your story. We appreciate your sharing it. I want to try and get another call or two in here. Thanks very much for your call. Andrea is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrea. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Interesting conversation so far.
Good. What do you got?
It's actually, I find it a somewhat amusing story. And my father was a CPA and actually was convicted of tax evasion and did serve time.
So the accountant goes to jail. Okay.
I think they really went after him and made an example of him because he was a CPA.
Yep.
But, I can kind of empathize with the caller that said he cheats whenever he can because he feels there's so many loopholes for businesses and things like that.
But yep.
Although I think what my father did was wrong, he argued selective enforcement and things like that, which really, it's no basis. But, there's very little that you can do to fight the injustices and inequities in the system. You know, Dennis Kozlowski and Tyco, I'm sure he deducted from their corporate taxes the amount that went towards his wife's birthday party.
Right.
Yet the average Joe can't do that.
Andrea, we hear that loud and clear. Our time
really
is short.
It's unfair, and what can you do about it?
We've got it. Our time is short. I'm going to let you go, but I've got it loud and clear, and it really goes, Richard Yancey, to the bottom line point I'm hearing out of all this tonight. It is essential that the tax system be kept fair. Otherwise, how do you keep people on board?
Yeah, and again, that's what I say in the Times piece. You know, that is the linchpin of the system. That's the linchpin of it's got, you have got to believe that the person who pays taxes has to believe that, you know, maybe they think they're, you know, paying the rates too high or whatever, but if they don't think the taxes the tax laws are being administrated fairly, and if they don't think the tax laws themselves treat people fairly in terms of how much they have to pay, then the whole system is in a danger of collapsing. And it doesn't matter how mean a tax collector is or how scared people might be of the tax collecting agency. If that basic belief that our tax system is fair is shaken, like it seems to be, you know, be happening more and more every year, then you've got a real problem.
Well, let's clean it up. Let's fix it up. And Richard Yancey, thanks a lot for your book and your insight into the inside life of an IRS collector. Thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure, Tom.
Richard Yancey, author of Confessions of a Tax Collector, One Man's Tour of Duty Inside the IRS. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amata, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help tonight from Paul Ruest and Argo Networks in New York. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.